Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and here at Bruegel, we are undergoing a research project on the future of work and inclusive growth in Europe. The project analyzes the impact of technology on the nature, quantity, and quality of work, welfare systems, and inclusive growth at large. The Sound of Economics is proud to contribute to the project with a space for discussion and analysis on this theme. And I'm happy to be accompanied today by Mario Mariniello, who is the Senior Fellow at Bruegel coordinating the project. Hi Mario, how are you?
Hi everybody, good, thank you for hosting us.
In this episode, we will look into the impact of technology on the job market with David Spencer, who is Professor of Economics and Political Economy at the Leeds University and a member of the Excellence Network of our Future Work and Inclusive Growth Project. Welcome to The Sound of Economics, Professor Spencer.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here and I'm grateful for the invite. Look forward to the discussion.
Great. If I may, I'll call you David.
That's fine.
Great. You seem to argue that the debate around the effect of technology and how to address risk as often an inherent flow from the outset, because it presumes that what we see is the only possible world. However, technology is, in your words, the product of unequal power. Can you elaborate further on this, and how should this insight help us frame in the discussion for future worlds where new technologies we know nothing or little about will become predominant? For example, the metaverse, which is so much in fashion at the moment.
Okay, thanks. I'm not sure I'm going to say very much about the metaverse, but let me try and sketch out some broad aspects of my research, which will then help me answer that question. So I've written several papers on the topic of the future of work, looking at the effects of digital technologies on work, both the quantity and quality of work, also on wages. And within those papers, I place emphasis upon the importance of power in shaping the effects and outcomes of digital technologies. So in that sense, make clear that technological change is not neutral. It's shaped by interests and interest groups. And there is a power relationship between capital and labor, which is important then in determining the effects and outcomes of technological change in society. So what sort of debates am I engaging with here? Well, I'm engaging with what are highly topical debates, and I think Bruegel are engaging with these and are key contributors to these debates at the moment. This is around automation and the future of work. This idea that technology is accelerating now, will accelerate in the future. It will be highly disruptive. It will transform the way we work. It will also transform the way we live. It will have transformational change on all parts of our life. Specifically in terms of work, there are these end of work type theses out there which suggest that technology will take jobs. Robots will eat all the jobs. We see these headlines a lot and often backed by evidence. Different estimates of job losses, lots of debates on that. So in terms of my take on that, I would say a sympathetic critic of these debates. So I see problems in these debates, one of which is a lack of consideration of power relationships. But I see benefit also in the debates, specifically in terms of broadening our economic imagination about what the future might be like and what the future should be like as well. So even though I find problems, and I'll outline those problems in a moment, I also see opportunities and potentialities in this debate for us to make critical and valuable contributions to debates about reshaping the future of work in a way which benefits all, and not, as there is a risk at the moment, benefits some at the expense of others. So there's different perspectives within this debate. There's like mainstream views about digital technologies accelerating. There's the risks there about higher unemployment, higher inequality. There's need for policy responses to that in terms of reskilling. Those sorts of debates are there. This is always couched in terms of things like, you know, the fourth industrial revolution, the second machine age. These sorts of terms are used there. So there is a sort of mainstream debate there. prominent in policy circles. I should say we've seen this debate before, you know, long-standing debates, and this continuity is here, you know, about the disruptive effects of technology. So that those sorts of debates which make various warnings about the future of work, but there is a suggestion there that work is going to be eroded and jobs will go. There's particular focus on losses in the volume of work, that job losses will rise. And then there's a sort of radical take which is linked to sort of post-work views about automation freeing us from work, the potential then for a brighter future where we transcend current work relations and create this sort of techno-utopia. But within that, there is a similar type of argument to the mainstream one about the end of work. Okay, what are the problems in that debate? I think there's an overstating of the potential for jobs to go. I think the clear elephant in the room in terms of this debate is that jobs are not declining. We live in economies with lots of jobs. These jobs are not going. And where technology is evolving, it's creating new jobs. So there's new job creation. So, you know, the continuities are missed there. And the tendency for technology to create more jobs is missed. And I think, though, then there's a lack of consideration of how technology may have job-preserving impacts, but then the real impacts, potential negative impacts, are more in terms of changes in the quality of work and how then jobs may persist, but jobs reduce in quality. Some jobs will improve, some jobs may get worse. You know, we can see examples of that in terms of a lot of gig economy now, you know, technology being used to create new jobs, but those jobs are argued often to be of lower quality than jobs which exist in the past, you know, lower wages and the like. And also as well, technology being used to worsen the quality of work. So I think here of things like surveillance at work, that to give one prominent example of how, and this goes back to the power relations point, that technology is not neutral. Who's calling the shots? It tends to be those who own capital, those with power within firms who are then likely to adopt technology which is in their own interest, which will lead to things like speed up, more monitoring at work, not necessarily then leading to improvements in the quality of work. And where workers have weak bargaining power, they're much less likely to resist that those changes. So that's a really long-winded answer, but that's setting some sort of context in terms of the debates and some of the issues around power. But I'm happy to elaborate on some of those points. I know I've spoken for probably too long there.
That's okay, because you really went wider and framed the terms of the debate. We've done this also in other podcasts in our mini-series about the future work, where we are trying to review a little bit the literature around the automation theorists that are growing and growing in the field. I would like to give Mario the opportunity to react to you, but just one thing that inspired me in your conversation, which would probably be just a parallel podcast, so I don't think we can answer it in one word, but basically one of the points that you've made is clearly an overlap sometimes in the literature at the moment, and a little bit of a confusion, I would say, when speaking about the future of work, especially on the techno-optimist side, between the debate on work and the debate on like post-work and so on, and the debate on post-scarcity, for example. Those two debates sometimes overlap, but sometimes don't overlap. But maybe we can come back to this a little bit later, because you might have something to say about that specific point. But Mario, I'm sure that you have a lot of interesting remarks from this.
No, I don't know. I mean, actually, the interesting remarks come from David. And I mean, I have to say that, I mean, I'm very fascinated. You touch upon many, many things. So it's difficult to pick where to keep on, you know, discussing. Indeed, I mean, there's so many podcasts we could have on this. But I mean, first, the one general comment, I find very fascinating the introduction that you made of this, which is, you know, sometimes when we debate about the future of work, we tend to take what we observe as given, right? I mean, the situation that we have. We are kind of locked in a certain narrative. This is the technology. This is what is happening. How can we address the issues that we see? But you are kind of challenging that. You are saying, well, you know, this is not given. I mean, like, this is the outcome of a process, of a struggle of power. So maybe we should go at the roots of that and try to understand what is driving this this process, why we are here instead of a different world. And I think that is very, very interesting, as and it's not an academic discussion at all. That's why Giuseppe mentioned the metaverse. That, I mean, like, it's something, I mean, maybe a lot of people are talking about without even knowing what it's going to be. But it's just an example to say, well, there are going to be different worlds in the future. And so now we have to reflect on where we are now and how we got here in order to avoid that in the future we are again locked in a, you know, in a world that we haven't contributed to shape. So I think this discussion is very, very important. But if I may follow up on something a little bit more concrete. So, I mean, the usual techno-optimist, you know, answer to the quantitative question, what is going to happen on the number of jobs, is to say, okay, I look at what happened in the past, and basically any measure technological revolution basically led to a net increase in the number of jobs. So you shouldn't be worried. I mean, like, it's just going to be a transformation. But there are two things. First of all, the transition is going to be costly, and is going to be costly for certain types of workers, those who have skills that cannot be complemented by technology, but actually are substituted by technology. So what do we do for those people that are going to suffer the most from the transition? And actually, we cannot expect that all truck drivers will become data analysts, right? I mean, like, you know, somebody is going to be definitely be worse off. I mean, like, even if on aggregate level, we will have more jobs than before, first of all. And second, I mean, like, I would like you to go a little bit deeper on indeed the qualitative impact that technology is having on jobs, on workers, really. Because maybe, I mean, like, we will have more jobs than we had before, but if those jobs are actually, you know, leading workers to feel worse, to have a lower well-being, well, maybe we are not really in a good place. So if you could just say what you think about these two, transition and the quality of work, it would be great to know what you think.
Okay. I mean, on the second point, I mentioned earlier how it's important to give attention to the way that technology changes the way that work is conducted. But then to be aware that then the way that technology is implemented is not necessarily always in the interests of workers. And in that sense, workers are potentially at risk of not losing their jobs, but facing declines in their quality of work. And that may, you know, again, there's long-standing debates on this, you know, critical literatures in sociology around de-skilling, how employers have homogenized work in a way to drive down wages, speed up work intensity through changes in technology. So technology's being used there, not necessarily in ways which benefit workers. Now, I think the modern concern is around, I think, speed up and work intensity. Also, hours worked as well, where you get this always-on culture where, you know, smartphones connect us to work on an ongoing basis. I'm at work even though I'm not at work. And in that sense, I remain in my job, but then my job lasts longer. There's a bitter irony in all this, of course, in that technology was supposed to liberate us from work. This was Keynes's big prediction, remember, in 1930, this idea that, you know, by 2030, we'd all work less. You know, that's not happened. I think work hours, work hour flexibility in particular, or the quality of work hours, our ability to set our hours is important in terms of the quality of our work. And if work then is making us work longer, that's a problem. I think the issue there is about control, workers having a say in how technology is designed, implemented, more democratizing technology, democratizing workplaces in a way then that can minimize bad outcomes and maximize good outcomes, create win-win outcomes, reduce the skewed outcomes that we're seeing at the moment where certain groups are benefiting a lot from technology where others are not. I mean, your other point about transitions, yes. I mean, you're interested, your truck driver's example is an interesting one because in the UK at the moment, there's a big shortage of truck drivers. You know, there's no prospect of automation. It's on the, you know, at least at the moment, you know, that we could talk more about this in a moment, but the sense in which though, you know, truck drivers are in high demand, human truck drivers. You know, bus drivers are being tempted to become truck drivers. So it's labor intensive still in that sense. Now, my point would be there, though, that won't persist, and there may then be a spur to automation because, in simple terms, capital is faced with more highly priced labor. And automation then will be the product of labor becoming more expensive. And I think that's important because that then underlines a general point. Whilst cheap labor remains, automation won't happen. And I wrote a paper about UK and the prospects for automation. And the UK economy is a low-wage, low-productivity economy. You know, the problem in the UK is too few robots. We don't have enough automation, but that's because of the nature and structure of the economy. You know, there aren't any modernizing forces within the economy which would lead to that, you know, kickstart automation. I think one product of the pandemic, if I just get ahead of myself here, is that, you know, the pandemic is leading to labor shortages, tight labor markets, not a disappearance of jobs. And that may spur automation. That may be an outcome of the pandemic, that labor shortage problem. One thing that occurred to me in this response in some ways to Giuseppe as well is that the future's open. I don't have any sort of, you know, crystal ball which allows me to predict the future. I think the future is fundamentally open. It's for us to shape. It's for us to shape in a way which is better than it is now. And this is what, going back to my sympathetic criticism of the debates, I think, again, it broadens our economic imagination. It gets us to focus on what a better future might be. Now, the post-work people, I think, have something interesting to say, but they miss certain things. You know, one thing they miss is the need to improve the quality of work, for example. You know, I think a post-work future might be quite dull if it doesn't involve much work, where work can be a good thing. And what I have in my head there is the idea of promoting a future where we have better work plus shorter work hours, and that would be a good vision to achieve. So I digress there, but I was conscious of...
Can I jump in one second?
Yes, of course.
No, I mean, I was wondering whether you have in mind specific policy interventions for that. You are aware of what the European Commission has been proposing on the Artificial Intelligence Act. So, like, you know, to you know, introduce some kind of you know, ethical framework that would, for example, avoid the misuse of certain type of application of artificial intelligence, including artificial intelligence in the workplace. So what the European Commission calls high-risk applications. So that's, for me, okay, certainly we can improve the text, but it's a step in the right direction. But I was wondering whether you have, you know, other things in mind.
Okay, I can't say I'm familiar with every word in that report, but my sense is that there's a lot of discussion now at EU level about things like reskilling and upskilling, more and better education and training, and that's in response to this digital disruption, and also emphasis upon data privacy as well, which links to the ethics of data use and collection, which I think is important, particularly important now in the context of COVID, where workers are having to pass on lots of data and how that data is used. I think, though, for me, it would be good to broaden the parameters of debate around policy. So, I mean, what I have in my head as some sort of perhaps unfeasible at the moment policy intervention, or maybe not unfeasible, I don't know, is to think about changes in governance. This idea, and to promote ideas of democracy at work. So, in some ways, these are quite old-fashioned, long-standing ideas, but it's creating better workplaces, creating workplaces in which there's dialogue, there's partnership. There's some engagement between managers and workers about the design and implementation of technology, and some you know, development of a social contract, both at the workplace and societal level, about how we share the benefits of technology. So it's not just leaving things to the market, leaving things to an unequal distribution of power to resolve things, but rather try to sort of build new institutions or reinforce existing institutions. We know that there is evidence on there. You know, Germany has higher levels of investment, more robots than the UK. Some, you know, workers work shorter hours there. the pay rates are higher. That relates to the sort of co-determination industrial relations system which exists there. UK, low wage economy, high levels of inequality, long work hours. So there is scope for reform there. So I have those sorts of things in my head in terms of changes in governance, shifts in ownership and control, corporate governance changes, workers on boards, those sorts of things would be useful. Empowering trade unions, creating social partnership. One specific thing I also have in my head, if I just throw this in, is sort of work time reduction as well. I'm thinking about that.
No, David, I wanted to just add on one thing. What do you think about universal basic income in this list?
Okay, I have mixed views about it. The universal basic income is something which is taken up both by left and right. So we have Elon Musk advocating for it. Why does Elon Musk advocate for it? In part to ensure that consumption remains a force in society when there's a potential for jobs to be lost. You know, people can keep spending money. Well, that's my crude take on it, at least. Hopefully he's not listening to this podcast. But so there's that sense in which there's a mainstream support for UBI, which relates to automation. There's a radical take about reducing workers' dependency on income. And this is the idea of a move to a post-work, post-capitalist future. I think there's problems with the UBI in terms of its feasibility, its cost. There's a contribution problem. You know, people getting something for nothing, which creates problems. But if people get money, that doesn't mean to say that they're going to get better roads, better hospitals, better schools. That suggests then the need for a universal basic services, which is often offered as an alternative. Okay, those criticisms are often made. I think my biggest concern with the universal basic income is it provides income but not work. And what do I mean there? I don't mean just giving work for the sake of giving work, but work can be good. People can gain meaning through work. And I think, you know, universal basic income suggests that if we provide a universal basic income, it's argued that workers are empowered in labour markets and can demand better work. Okay, but that's quite an indirect route to achieve it. Why not just try and promote better work if better work's the objective? And even with a basic income, universal basic income, work would continue. You know, we need work potentially to continue to fund it. So there's ethical issues then about the quality of work. Do we just accept work being a bad thing, or do we try and make it better? This is why I have what drives in some ways my research is this vision of a better future, where technology then is not about eliminating work, it's about eliminating bad work, and it's about creating good work. Because in my vision of the future, if my view matters at all, it is creating a world where all activities we perform are good. And that would involve us two doing work potentially, but under different conditions, and where, you know, we can contribute positively through work, but also through leisure. That would involve us working less, but it would also then us having meaningful work. And I don't see that in the post-work arguments. And I don't necessarily see that in UBI type arguments. UBI may have its place, a sort of emergency measure, transitional measure, but I think we need other policies beyond it, and it can become a potential distraction from those other policies.
Yeah, I mean, I fully agree with you on on the universal basic income. I really have exactly the same view. I also think that there are a number of policy files that are going in parallel that are they are relevant to this, including, for example, those that aim to stimulate more competition in product and service markets. So, I mean, like, of course, if you shift the responsibility, for example, for services to individuals, because you say you have to cut public service and just, you know, give the money to individuals, then you expose them even more to markets where there is no competition. Therefore, I mean, there is a higher risk that more value will be extracted from them and indeed taken by the companies that have monopoly power. So, I mean, I think we have to see the full picture with all the different files at the same time. And you know, everything has to work perfectly in order, you know, potentially for this this to work. And I don't see it at the moment. So I agree with that. I wanted to just go back to something that you said about the participation of workers in this. I think it's very, very important. I fully agree with you. And I mean, I wanted to touch upon again on the Artificial Intelligence Act, because it seems to me that the European Commission has this tendency of trying to aim to have a technology which is the best possible, so let's say the most unbiased one, let's say, the one that try to eliminate from the outset the risk that is somehow intrinsic in the technology. But the problem is really with use, because even if you have like a perfectly unbiased technology, when you get it like on the workplace and you're using it, you still have like a distributional effect. You're still affecting individuals, even if you know that they are perfectly evaluated, right? But maybe you have a constant monitoring going on. So for me, this is a very, very important point that you made. I mean, like, it's very important that, you know, workers are involved into the assessment of artificial intelligence, also at the level of use, really at plant level. You know, I mean, they see, they can be involved in understanding. I mean, like in expressing what is the effect in their daily life, really. That has to. I mean, it's missing at the moment in the text proposed by the European Commission. This is very dangerous. And the last thing that I wanted to mention is that we are doing some work. We are about to publish a paper on the use of biometrics technology in the workplace. And for example, we have seen that there is a lot of adoption going on in certain sectors, but at the same time, we don't see a reduction in fatality rates or, you know, injury rates. Somehow, you know, technology could have a potential super beneficial use for workers. For example, you know, protecting them from work injury, which is a major issue that I don't think is enough in the policy rather. But technology is not doing that. So I think that involving more workers and, you know, making them aware also of how technology can help them to protect them would really help in that sense, because it could also push employers to adopt those technologies that are actually really improving their well-being and safety. So I mean, it's very important.
Can I just jump in there? One other point to make on the back of that is that if workers are involved in the technological process, they can come up with ideas which have previously not been explored. This is the problem. You know, if there's biases in technology, if it's just one group, maybe, you know, let's call them the innovators coming up with the ideas, they're missing out on the workers who are using the technology. And, you know, think about feedback loops, going back to your point. So, you know, what's the experience of the technology? Is it working? No. How could it be improved? Well, workers probably have got better knowledge of that than the innovators. And it's that sense in which we, you know, we need to get to it. This is going back to my democracy point of just trying to create fora where workers have a voice. And that democracy then will, I think, produce better outcomes, better technology, more equal outcomes, better work, more leisure time. It's these outcomes. Again, this is why I find this debate seductive, because it does raise important questions. And this is why we should applaud those contributing, even if we may criticize them. But, you know, we can criticize in a way where we can go forward, I think, and come up with better outcomes.
We are going towards the end of this episode, because we could go on discussing these issues for very, very long. But I still wanted to ask a final question about the pandemic and what we have learned from the pandemic, and if there are things, there are seeds of things, of experimentations, of some of the stuff that we've been speaking, that especially David, you've been outlining as possible futures. I know we can read the pandemic in many ways. We can read some of the stuff that we've been doing and experimenting as brilliant and going into a completely positive direction, but also there are a lot of things that might be leading towards a dystopian future. So what's your take on this, and what are the lessons learned?
Okay. Well, if you look specifically at technology, the pandemic has shown how forces of technological change can be accelerated. So we're having a conversation online. We probably wouldn't have done that necessarily before. I'm teaching online. higher education where I work has been transformed. Lots of other workplaces have been transformed. Moves to home working, which has involved use of technology. We're buying more of our goods online, more so than we did before. That's involved new uses of technology. There are regressive elements. So, you know, employers are now increasingly investing in remote forms of surveillance that, you know, we're monitored even though we're not at work. And that then, you know, again, suggests how technology is not necessarily neutral in its effects. I think the pandemic has also shown the limits of technology as well. Who have been the heroes in the pandemic? Nurses, carers, doctors, delivery drivers, retail workers. That it's shown us that, you know, human labor matters and that there are certain things in the world that we might not want to be automated. We want doctors and nurses to care for us. And in that sense, it's shown us the limits of automation and the value of labor, human labor. Also at the same time, how labor's undervalued. Carers do not get paid much, nor do retail workers. So my hope would be that sort of on the back of the pandemic, we can reevaluate some of this vital human labor. These essential workers, in the UK, we applauded them, but really we should pay them more. So there's a debate there. Okay, in terms of the future, I mentioned the point about labor shortages accelerating automation. That seems to be a byproduct rather than a direct product of the pandemic. There is a lot of debate now about building back better, this idea of creating a better future. I think these debates have some force. They can also be quite long on rhetoric and in that sense hide an attempt to restore things as they were before the pandemic. I would hope that we can use that space to come up with new ideas, new policies to create a better world, one which is more robust and resilient in the face of pandemics, but also one which is better for everybody, better in terms of the work that we do, the lives that we lead, the technology we use. So that sense in which we can harness technology better under different conditions. So I think there is a groundswell of opinion now sort of building for a different society. Time will tell whether that will bear any fruit. But going back to my sympathetic criticism and all that stuff, you know, I remain an optimist. The idea in which we can build a better future. And this is what I think these future work debates are very important. I think the work that Bruegel's doing is very important as well in terms of trying to craft in our heads what it might be, this better future, and then seek to realize it through better policies.
Thank you, David, for those last words, because they really sum up the overall debate, I would say. And of course, I cannot close the podcast without giving a word to Mario as well, who has been a co-pilot with me today.
Thank you, Giuseppe. But I mean, I shouldn't say anything, because I think what David just said, I mean, I agree 100%. And I mean, it was really an honor and a pleasure to have you here with us. Thank you very much, really.
Thank you also from my side. And this brings us then to the end of this episode. And I would like to remind our listeners that it was part of a research project here at Bruegel on future work and inclusive growth in Europe. And The Sound of Economics will keep following the project, and there will be more episodes dedicated to the theme to come. And as usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. Thanks a lot for joining The Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.